Good evening, everybody. Thank you for sharing your evening with us tonight. So sometimes things happen to remind us that the world is burning. This evening, we learned a little about the life of a young woman. And Jeff, I don't think Jeff mentioned, but just like Elizabeth MacDonald's son, James Sullivan, Hillary died from complications of the swine flu, sudden respiratory failure. Even in the hospital, they couldn't do anything. And maybe during the memorial service, thoughts came to mind of other people who are gone, who have left under different circumstances, probably circumstances we did not want. And thoughts might arise in our mind about what happened at Fort Hood in Texas just a few days ago. When Major Nidal Malik Hassan opened fire. And I was able to find a list of the names of the 13 people who died. In that, I don't know what to call that, in that event. And their names are John Gaffney, Jason Hunt, Amy Kruger, Aaron Nemelka, Michael Pearson, Russell Seeger, Francesca Velez, Kam Jung, Michael Cahill, Juanita Warman, Eduardo Carvalho, Justin DeCrow, and Frederick Green. It takes a while just to say those names. I got those names from the New York Times website, which has a very beautiful feature that they built where there are the pictures and the names of these 13 people, and you can click on, and the pictures are sort of dim, like they're halfway gone. And then you click on there, and the picture lights up. They sort of spring into life, and you can learn about them. So I tried to read about all three of them, all 13 of them. And of course, each person seems interesting and impressive. Somebody you wish you had known, just like I wish I had known Hillary. Somebody who worked hard, made mistakes, overcome a lot of problems. People who loved each other and had children and sisters and brothers and parents and friends, and now not here. But not exactly gone either. Then also yesterday, I think last evening, the government of Virginia killed John Muhammad. He was 43, I read, the exact same age that I am. John Muhammad lived in Bellingham for a while. He slept at the mission worked out at the YMCA. We may well have seen him on the streets with his young sort of protege, I guess, Lee Malvo. And Lee Malvo will spend the rest of his life in prison. Because, as I'm sure you remember, they spent some time lurking around shopping malls, shooting people with a rifle. What's strange about these stories is that that sounds pretty horrible. But somehow, sometimes little details really make it real, more horrid. And they said on the news, I didn't know this from when it happened, that they had carefully modified the trunk of their car so they could be comfortable in the trunk of the car for long periods of time and see out from the trunk and decide who they were going to shoot and shoot them. And the news article said that the jury chose to recommend the death penalty because John Muhammad showed no apparent remorse. And every day in the paper, every day almost now, I mean, we're getting used to this, there's another bombing in Pakistan or Iraq or Afghanistan. And we have no way of really finding out the names or the stories of those 10 people or 20 people or 30 people or 80 people who died. Who were their brothers and sisters and mothers? Who were their fathers and sons and daughters? And every day, not in the paper, because it's too diffuse and too normal, I guess, there's so many more deaths from disease and war and violence, malnutrition and poverty in this radically mixed up, poorly organized world. The AIDS pandemic continues to ravage Africa long after it got out of the headlines. I guess it's not as terrible as it was at its peak, but it continues to be very horrible. There are nearly 7,000 deaths a day in Africa from AIDS, I found out, which is 2.3 million deaths a year. Which, even compared to a total population, there are a lot of people in Africa, there are 950 million people in Africa, is still a lot. We have about a third that number of people in the United States, but only about a tenth that number of deaths from HIV/AIDS. And swine flu, as scary as it is for us now, touching families that we know, acting in the way that the flu is not supposed to act. Because I was talking to Edie Norton on the phone today, and she said, well, there's many more deaths from regular seasonal flu, but those are usually people who are already in some way compromised or ill. And so that feels sort of more okay. But it doesn't feel okay for someone who's otherwise healthy and in their middle 20s to suddenly die from the flu. But even still, that's small numbers yet. Fewer than 5,000 deaths have been reported from H1N1 flu worldwide. So less than one day of the AIDS pandemic in Africa. And yet, Hillary McKenna is not a number or a statistic. It does not make it okay that she is only one. She is a young woman who worked hard to become who she was, like Jeff was telling us. and what a remarkable person his sister must be, and her partner, Mary Jo, to have loved Hillary so steadily all these years. And then in her 20s, finally coming to some stability and happiness, and now gone. And a few days ago, last Thursday, I think it was, when I dropped my son Walker off at the bus stop in the morning, just like any other morning, one of his classmates, a little second grade girl, says to me, "Well, my brother can't go to school because his school burned down." I said, "What?" I didn't really quite believe her. But I took a little detour on the way home, and I walked over by Whatcom Middle School, and sure enough, it was on fire. Flames coming out, and big fire trucks, and lots of people, and lots of police cars, and all the incredible resources that we can bring to bear. But mostly, even the professionals just watching as they poured more water into the building. And it was sort of horrible, and sort of, there was a sort of sense of wonder to it. A sort of sense of awe. Of all that old wood from that turn of the century building. What we now call old growth fir, but when they earlier just called them trees, probably, because they were so regular and normal, now rare. These strong, dense trees, full of energy, gathered over hundreds of years, maybe 1,000 years, some of the older trees, before our ancestors, the Euro-American people, arrived here. So it struck me as both a disaster and a problem, but also like something so natural. And sort of wonderful in a way, a completion of something. The exhalation after a long, careful inhalation of building, the building and many thousands of students and teachers teaching and maintaining and trying to do their thing in that building, trying to waste not the hour. Have you been by Whatcom Middle School? That's what it says on the facade. It says, "Waste not thy hour." And they're moving the 8th graders to Bellingham High School, which I guess is big enough after they did a remodel there that they had sort of like a free wing. And in the free wing, they made paper Doric columns and a paper sign that says, "Waste not thy hour." So the kids would feel welcome, or at least like sort of normally annoyed when they arrive. And I did feel so badly for the teachers, mostly. Having been, albeit briefly, a school teacher myself, I know a little bit the great effort that goes into those file cabinets that burned up. Those lessons and worksheets and handouts and plans and books, all destroyed a little bit by fire, but mostly probably by the fighting of the fire. It was kind of amazing to watch. I stayed for a while and watched the firefighters. I hadn't really realized, I mean, it's obvious if you think about it, but you have to see these things with your eyes, I think, that firefighting is really unbelievably destructive. They knock holes in the building and pour in immense amounts of water from very high pressure hoses, break windows and doors, knock holes in walls, and ruin the building, basically, to stop it from burning up anymore, and to stop it from burning up the block, or the neighborhood, or the whole city. Which is what used to happen to wooden cities all the time before they had all these tools, I suppose. And then I found myself thinking about the chemistry of this. there are any organic chemists in the audience, you can correct me later if I have this screwed up, but I think it all comes down, in all these cases, it comes down to molecules, you know, and atoms, if we think about it. That's all we are, molecules and atoms. And fires can happen because of the incredible ability of molecules and atoms to change state and store and release energy. Photosynthesis allows plants to create molecules in their cells with energy bound up in them. Some of the energy is bound up in the way the atoms are connected together in the molecules, and some in the interactions between the electrons and the nuclei of the molecules. So even though a hunk of wood looks inert to us with our limited senses, even if it's 100 years old, or 1,000 years old, it's full of energy, vibrating and pulsing with energy. These super speed electrons moving around, and I guess they don't even really understand how they move. Even just sitting here, the electrons on the surface of the wood are interacting with the air. And even just sitting here, the wood is very slowly oxidizing. Electrons are always looking for a chance, I guess, to hop into a stray oxygen molecule and release a little energy. Especially if the oxygen molecules are by themselves. O2, which is two oxygen atoms bound together to make a pretty stable molecule, that's pretty stable. But there's always, I guess, little bits of single oxygen molecules floating around, which is what they call ozone, which is quite reactive. So in a way, you could say that the lectern is very slowly, burning. And wood is mostly made up of a molecule called cellulose, which has quite a few carbon and hydrogen and oxygen, maybe one other one, maybe a few nitrogen atoms in it. And there's a lot of energy in the bonds in between these atoms in this cellulose molecule, which the tree has built from the energy of the sun. Stored it in there, packed that energy in there while building its own structure. And like I say, this energy does very slowly leak out of the edges. Nothing really can quite stay contained. It's impossible to really contain anything. Everything's always leaking and changing and merging. But then I found out what I didn't realize is what happens when wood heats up. If it gets hot enough where the wood is, the cellulose molecules start to split apart. Try to break apart just because of the heat. They start vibrating too much, I guess. Because energy is just vibration. And then when the cellulose molecules start to break apart, two things happen. One is the very energy in those bonds is released. And the other is now you have all these individual atoms flying around. Instead of being in this nice, stable, if energetic molecule, there's these individual atoms flying around ready to like pass electrons, like pass the hot potato or something. And pretty soon you have a chain reaction where more energy is released, making more heat, breaking up more molecules, generating more energy, and you have what we call a fire. A chain reaction that will keep going until something puts an end to it. Like an enormous firefighter hose. or just running out of fuel. And then here's a little side note. I didn't know this. I read an article that says, if you look really closely at a fire, like campfire, or maybe a fire on a match, I'm not sure if it works on a... There's a lot of chemicals in the end of the match, which might make this hard to see. They said if you look really closely, there's a little gap in between the wood and the fire. A little gap. And that's because it turns out the wood is not actually itself on fire. It's releasing energy and flammable gases, and the gases are on fire. So that's where the little gap is, where the gases are coming out, I guess. The wood is oxidizing quickly, releasing gases, and those are on fire. So it turns out that even really everyday things that we thought we knew how they worked, we don't really know. Luckily, we have the internet, so we can find out. And what you read on there is definitely right. So anyway, if you think about it, it's completely inevitable and very natural that things made out of wood will burn. Like, not like they might burn, but that they will burn sooner or later. I remember reading that in Japan, they have these very ancient wooden buildings, temples, and all kinds of buildings that are wood. And and the way they look at it is, this building is 2,000 years old. And then you read the history, and it says it burned down completely in 1623, and they built a new one. And from our point of view, we're like, no, this is only 400 years old, because it burned down. From their point of view, no, that's just part of, it's just part of the story of this building. You know, all buildings burn down and are rebuilt. It's just how it goes. And it makes perfect sense. It's not like we're idiots. It's a good idea to make things, buildings out of wood. It's a great material given to us by the earth, built by the sun and the air. I mean, it's amazing. But we forget what we're doing. That we're building our buildings with energized materials that are vibrating intensely, powered up, waiting to burst into flames. So maybe learning science can help us a little bit. In the same way that learning Buddhist teachings, learning spiritual teachings can help us. That if we can change our attitude and recondition our habitual way of looking at things so that we are more in line with the way reality actually is, we will not suffer as much. We will be more able to move through the world without being knocked down by burning buildings and dying children. And the other thing about the process of oxidation, this giving up of molecules and generating energy, merging with the universe, the other thing about oxidation is that's what powers us, too. The exact same process is what allows our bodies to move and live and have energy. Because you think about it, all of our food, all of it, originates in the same process of photosynthesis that created the wood for Whatcom Middle School. This is true whether we're eating plants directly or eating animals that ate those plants. And then our body cleverly reworks the molecules in the food into new molecules that can store energy, just like wood. Only we use glucose molecules instead of cellulose molecules that are in wood. And then those glucose molecules, which, in case you're interested, have 6 carbon, 12 hydrogen, and 6 oxygen atoms in them. They can move around our body and into our cells. I think they can move through cell walls. And then they burn up in the same chemical reaction, just like burning of wood. And very amazingly, if you chart out that chemical reaction, the chemistry of the glucose burning to make energy for our cells is the exact opposite of the chemical reaction that happens in plants when photosynthesis interacts with carbon dioxide and builds molecules, sugar molecules in the plants. So isn't that amazing? So we are burning. And plants use the sun, and the sun is burning. And the plants use the sun's energy to sort of unburn and store that energy for us to burn again. Everything burning and unburning in a great chain reaction. And with all this energy flowing around, it's no wonder that the forms and details and timing of things does not run particularly to our preferences. Big old school buildings burn up after 100 years instead of 200 or 500 like we would prefer, or until we have a committee decision to tear it down, or whenever we would like it to burn. And people die at 25 years old or 25 weeks old instead of 85 years old like we'd prefer. And this great dance of form and emptiness keeps playing out in its own time on this infinite stage of reality. And so we have a real choice whether we're going to dance with this or just burn up. And I was thinking these basic chemical and energy interactions between things are really surprisingly in line with the Buddha's teachings. One of the Buddha's many big points, key points, is that reality is not the way we think it is. He said that reality has three sort of essential qualities. The first is that everything is impermanent. Nothing will stay the same. And the second is that things can only arise and appear out of their relationship with other things. There's nothing really separate and solid and individual. So we think that the lectern is a separate thing, but now we learn from science that it's burning slowly and interacting with the air around it and changing, and came originally from the air and the sun anyway, to which it will return. And the third point the Buddha made about the nature of reality is that our attempt to grab onto things and hold onto things will not give us the lasting satisfaction that we think it will. That as soon as you try to grasp onto something, a building or a loved one, you find that it's burning. It seemed to be here, but now it's not. And the Buddha gave a famous teaching on this called the Fire Sermon. And it's supposed to be one of the first ever teachings he gave after his enlightenment experience. So I want to read you the Fire Sermon. It's pretty short. He started out with really short, you know, the way it's written down now, it started out with really short teachings, and they got longer and longer and longer. That's just how it goes, I guess. So here's the Fire Sermon. Let's see what the Buddha said about all this. I have heard that on one occasion, the Blessed One was staying in Gaya, at Gaia Head with 1,000 monks. And 1,000, I guess, is code for a lot. He had a lot of monks. And we hope some nuns, too. There he addressed the monks. Monks, all is burning. What is burning? The eye is burning. Forms are burning. Consciousness at the eye is burning. Contact at the eye is burning. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the eye, and whatever you experience as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too is burning. Burning with what? Burning with the fire of passion, the fire of aversion, push things away, and the fire of delusion. Burning, I tell you, with birth, aging, and death. Burning with sorrows, lamentations, pains, distress, and despairs. And then he repeats that formula for the other senses. He says, monks, the ear, too, is burning. Sounds are burning. Contact with sounds and the consciousness that arises is burning. And everything that arises in dependence on contacts with the sound and the ear consciousness is burning with those same reasons. And likewise with the nose and smell, and the tongue and taste, all burning, and what we touch, and the body is burning, and the intellect, the mind sense is burning, ideas are burning. So this is interesting, because, you know, in Buddhism, there's the five senses that we think about, and the sixth sense is the mind that can think. And it's not thought to be you. It's thought to be a sense. That sense is thinking and ideas. So ideas are burning. Consciousness at the intellect is burning. Contact at the intellect is burning. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the intellect, so whatever arises as a result of awareness of thinking, so many things arise. You know, you don't have to sit too many periods of zazen to notice that a lot of things arise. Whether they're experienced as pleasure, no, he includes pleasure here, so listen carefully. Experiences pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, neutral. That too is burning. Burning with what? Burning with the fire of passion, the fire of aversion, the fire of delusion. Burning, I say, with birth, aging, and death, with sorrows, lamentations, pains, distress, and despairs. Translator says despairs, plural. You know, not just one, but many despairs. These are specific despairs, I guess. So he sets up the problem. That's a big problem. Everything is burning. And then he's going to set up the solution. Seeing thus, the well-instructed disciples of the noble ones grow disenchanted with the eye, disenchanted with forms, disenchanted with consciousness at the eye, disenchanted with contact at the eye. So there's a whole sort of Buddhist theory of perception that's being brought up here. It comes from pre-Buddhist Indian philosophy, that there's an organ, there's consciousness, there's contact, and this whole sort of little chain that happens. That's why they say contact. Whether this, disenchanted with all these things, and whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the eye, experiences pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, with that too, she grows disenchanted. And then, as before, This formula is repeated for the other five physical senses that we know about and with the mind. She also grows disenchanted with the intellect, disenchanted with ideas, disenchanted with consciousness at the intellect, disenchanted with contact at the intellect. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the intellect, whether experienced as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, he grows disenchanted with that too. Disenchanted, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, she is fully released. Fully released. With full release, there is the knowledge, fully released. And she discerns that birth is ended, the holy life fulfilled, the task is done. There is nothing further for this world. Nothing further to do. That is what the Blessed One said. Gratified, the monks were delighted at his words. And while this explanation was being given, the hearts of the 1,000 monks were liberated from taints and could cling no more. Which I think is great about the Buddha. You only had to listen to one Dharma talk. And then you were completely liberated. So this may sound a little funny to us. What's wrong with being enchanted? To be enchanted is in our culture a wonderful thing. To be enchanted with somebody. I was so enchanted by that movie, by that novel, by that sunset. Is he saying that we shouldn't love the world? That was all a mistake? That we should somehow like shut down and withdraw, live in a cave or something. And sometimes a narrow reading of early Buddhist teachings seems to lead to that conclusion. It could seem like a student of Buddhism should be cold and removed and uninvolved and sort of out of the fray. That being attached is bad, so being unattached must be good. And sometimes people come to the Dharma centers and that's like their first question is, well, how do I get unattached? I'm really tired of this, you know, how do I get unattached? What do I do? But if you read the way the Buddha, read more of the teachings, and they include quite a few stories about the ways that the Buddha interacted with the world and with the people around him. And you also meet his committed descendants to whom this understanding has been passed in person to person for all these years. You see that they're not that way. The fruits of practice do not seem to lead to being really cold and disengaged. Long-term students of the Buddha way are fully engaged and really are in love with the world. But it's a love that's not burning. Not so much clinging. A love that can feel both sides of this life. A love that can include gain and growth and birth and include death and loss and ending and disintegration. A love and engagement with the world that includes building the building and appreciating that it burns down. See, they can see birth and death not as opposites or enemies, but as two halves of the same coin. And the the chant we chant at noon, the Metta Sutta, our translation of it, makes that point at the very end. It says something like, the one who is, really understands this is not caught by the duality of birth and death, which is not really what the original says, but it's really good. It's good for us. And so, by disenchanted, he means not caught anymore, not trapped by this whirlwind of desire for things we want and aversion against things we don't want. And not even hanging out in neutrality. You notice he says that? Whether these things are experienced as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, they're still burning. So this is not like some trick to hide in some sort of gap. It's a transformation of our relationship to our body, our senses, our thinking, and the world. And the Buddha says all through his teachings that if we want to reduce suffering and therefore be available to other beings outside this busy, complicated one here, we need to really understand the limitations of our habitual way of looking at the world and our many unexamined assumptions that we make through this powerful idea that we are separate beings peering out through the out at some world out there through these little sort of holes. And what we see out there being solid and permanent hard wood. You know, have you ever worked with really all old growth fur? It's really hard. It's like a rock. You know, I can't particularly drive a nail into it. Bob can, I'm sure, but it's really hard. It seems so solid, you know. And it's so shocking when it burns up. And how we hear the wonderful sounds of children playing, and how we suffer when that stops. And how we think we understand the way things go and should go, and the way people should behave. And then we learn some more and realize, oh, our understanding was a little too narrow, too limited. And so we can expand and improve our view. We can learn the chemistry of fire and say, oh, okay, now I get it. But even then, the Buddha encourages us to remember that's still just a view, just an idea, not quite it. But some views may be more skillful than others and less inclined towards suffering. Buddha's teachings include working smart in a smart way with our mind, include study and careful thought. And I've been reading it. I never really read that much by the Dalai Lama. You know, they've got a million books out by him, or sort of putatively by him, you know, by him and different collaborators. And that's one of the points he makes a lot, is we have to study. You know, we really have to study. Study teachings, study our mind. There's not some sort of magic bullet practice that suddenly everything is better. We have to study, he says. He also, I'm told, does 4 hours of meditation a day, so there's some meditation and practice involved too. But he also says we have to study. Sorry?
He always says, think.
That's so good. It's really cute. You go to lectures by him and he'll speak in Tibet, and once in a while, to make a point, he breaks out into English.
Yeah,
and it's really so sweet, you know. Yeah. And so, in conclusion to my burning talk, let's talk about water for a minute. Because I was opening, I have these big books of translations of the Pali Canon, of the early teachings of Buddha. And we have some of them in the library here, too. And you can get most of this online, too, anyway, so you don't need the big books anymore if you have a computer. But anyway, I looked up the fire sermon in the big book because I wanted to see if it was a different, how that translation differed. And then I noticed the very first passage in that big book, which is called the Samyutta Nikaya. There's different collections, so it's one of the collections. It's the collection of connected discourses. And the very first passage, the very first little chapter in the Samyutta Nikaya somehow gives us some guidance about all this. Because one thing you might have noticed about the fire sermon is he doesn't particularly tell you how to become disenchanted. He just says, okay, now that you see this, become disenchanted. It implies careful study of how the mind really works and really feeling our suffering, but how do you get from A to B? You know, what's the difference between just wallowing in your suffering and engaging with the reality in a effective way? And so this other little teaching is about something you can do. And it's even shorter. I've heard that on one occasion, the Blessed One was staying near Savatthi in Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. And then a certain devata, which is like a sort of spirit being, a certain devata, in the far extreme of night, and presumably the Buddha was meditating all night, her extreme radiance lighting up the entirety of Jetta's Grove. So we have to imagine this, you know, we're in 5th century BC India, in the middle of the night, you know, there's no electric lights, right? It's really dark. And this radiant being appears, lighting up the whole bamboo forest, the whole grove. And she went to the Blessed One. On arrival, having bowed down to him, she stood to one side, which is like respectful. You wouldn't stand right in front of a person, somebody, you stand to the side. She stood to one side. And as she was standing there, she said to him, "Tell me, dear sir, how you crossed over the flood. How did you cross over the flood?" Buddha says, "I crossed over the flood without pushing forward and without staying in one place." And the devata said, "But how, dear sir, did you cross over the flood without pushing forward and without staying in one place?" And then the Buddha said, "When I pushed forward, I was whirled around by the currents. When I stayed in one place, I sank into the mud. And so I crossed over," I think they mean through, "crossed through the flood without pushing forward and without staying in one place." So, steadily. And then Devata said, "At long last, I see a Brahmin, totally unbound, who, without pushing forward, without staying in one place, has crossed through the entanglements of the world." And that is what the devata said, and the teacher approved. And realizing that the teacher has approved of me, she bowed down to him, circumambulated him, keeping him to her right, and then vanished. That nice. So life is like that, isn't it? It's like we're walking through a flood. Sometimes we try too hard, and we lean into it, we push, and we just get whirled around by the currents, right? Flung back somewheres. And other times we feel stuck, and we stop, and we don't know what to do, and we just sink into the mud. Fire and floods. How can we live in this burning world? Cross through the floods of ignorance, craving, and anger so that we can be of help to each other. Can we recognize and work with the world as it is? We're all dying, and we were all just born burning bodies, chain reacting chemical interactions, and we are Buddhas, and we will be extinguished. And the Zen masters used to be famous for sitting zazen right at the time of their death. They'd be like, okay, now's the time, sit in zazen and die. So maybe I should do that, just to make this more clear. Because we don't want to get this point, you know? We don't want to get this point. We really don't. But maybe I better not do that. Because we have work to do. There are suffering beings to help out of burning buildings. And lost beings to guide steadily across the floods. Thank you very much for listening.